Welcome to A New Lens with Common Good Capital, where we talk with investors, RIAs, fund managers, and philanthropists about their experiences within different impact investing themes, as well as explore the power of stewardship and capital. I'm your host, Jeff Schaefer, CEO of Common Good Capital, and I am here with Rob Hurlbutt. He's Managing Director and Co-Founder of Agriculture Capital, and for over 30 years, he's been investing in and leading regenerative farming companies, food companies. So I'm very much interested to dive into that. Rob's experience as a founder and CEO of several natural category food companies, along with his time as a director at Nestle, has informed him of his focus on the value of proprietary supply chain and the opportunity to connect regenerative practices to the value creation for all stakeholders. So this is probably a long shot. I know a guy, in fact, I'm meeting with him on Friday, a guy by the name of Dan Stroud, who was at Nestle. And he was CFO of part of it. Have you ever heard of, you know, Dan? Have you ever met him?
I don't know Dan. Nope.
Okay.
Big company.
Nestle has how many
and
people?
I was there 20 or 30, almost 30 years ago now, 25 okay. years ago. Okay. So yeah.
Well, last time I saw Dan, I said something about, I think candy bars. And he's like, Jeff, that's just like a gnat of what they do. So anyways. And I should say that Rob has a BA in psychology, which as do I, and social relations from Harvard University. I did not go to Harvard, but welcome and thanks for joining us.
Well, thanks for having me, Jeff. It's nice to be here.
Let's start off as we always do. Give us a little background of who you are, like, you know, where'd you grow up? Where'd you go to school? And then just a high level of your career, and then we'll dig in deeper.
I grew up in Boston, and I did not have any farming background other than, you know, grandparents who were living on a farm, but nothing that I could relate to distinctly. After college, I had the good fortune of following my girlfriend at the time, now wife, to San Francisco, where she was from, having been in Boston my whole career, and decided I wanted to live somewhere else at that point. And thought it would be a 2-year stint. And now, almost 40 years later, I still find myself in San Francisco. Upon getting out here, I found my way into a role trading commodities, which was actually a good build on my psychology degree. You know, the idea of kind of risk behavior and, you know, how people react in certain situations proved to be super useful, and developed a partnership with a couple of people trading coffee and cocoa futures specifically to manage primarily hedge positions within the coffee industry. So our clients were green bean traders, coffee growers, and coffee roasters all over the world. And it was, you know, prior to the internet, I was getting up at 3 a.m, typing a report after making phone calls all over the world to find out what was happening in the coffee trade, typing up a report and faxing it out to 500 clients before the markets opened, and then was on the phone all day, you know, trading positions for those hedge books primarily, which was a super interesting job. Very successful. We grew that business over the course of 7 years. And then I had a unique opportunity to go work for one of my customers, which was Nestle, to manage the risk portfolio for Nestle Beverage, which was also based in San Francisco at the time. And so that was a really important pivot for me, because I had a chance to learn a lot more about the food business, not just the financial side of the purchasing department. I ended up managing the coffee buying group at Nestle. Nestle is the largest coffee company in the world, still is. Within the US, we had a number of coffee brands. And so we were doing all the buying and risk management for those coffee businesses, everything from Hills Brothers, Nescafe, Taster's Choice, MJB, Chase and Sanborn, a whole bunch of brands that the company owned. So I was cupping coffee every day. I was literally tasting coffee. I could evaluate at the time the origin of any coffee bean I tasted on the planet. I'd spent a lot of time on the road traveling to meet with growers all over the world. And for me, it was one of the most impactful kind of opportunities, because I suddenly had a physical understanding of this financial instrument that I had been trading, and got to understand the impact of purchasing decisions that I was making on the lives of people all over the planet, not just the traders involved in the transaction itself, but the actual people who were harvesting coffee, the people who own those fincas and were running those businesses, and ultimately the consumers that we were selling coffee to in the US. So that was a kind of set me on a journey within the food industry Very different from the one that I had initially envisioned in financial. It's kind of in the financial side of the business.
So let me stop you for a second. If I could peer into your brain of that experience that you just described, what do you think would shock me or that would be ahas as I understand in this example, just the coffee industry and the flow of capital? Is there anything there that would that probably would shock me? Or
I think two things to me, I don't know if they're shocking, but one of the things I took for granted at the time was that we were making decisions on how much to pay for coffee based on the quality attributes of every particular lot of coffee. A lot of coffee is basically one container load of coffee. And we would go take samples of that coffee, or we have people who took samples of the coffee. They send it to my office. We had a guy there who roasted samples every day, put those out on a big round table. We'd actually cup the coffee, taste it, evaluate whether it was worth, you know, a discount to the New York Coffee, Cocoa and Sugar Exchange price quoted or a premium to it. Then we'd take that in, that evaluation and do sort of low cost blending to figure out how to achieve a consistent flavor profile in the coffee products that we are making at the lowest possible cost. That's sort of the job in a big coffee company. Quality, we are using quality as a way to really drive blending. For me, I just took it for granted that people traded food based on quality attributes. And so when I got out of the coffee part of the business, I suddenly, you know, realized, no, that is not the case. The only businesses historically that have done that is it has been sort of coffee and wine are two examples where, you know, people actually are evaluating the raw ingredient coming off of the farm as a fundamental driver of the ultimate product quality that a consumer is consuming. So that I thought was super interesting. And then obviously the other, this may be more obvious, is when you're seeing sort of the economic impact of big food decisions, you know, in this case, I was largely responsible for the financial performance of those coffee businesses based on how well I bought coffee. Mm-hmm. It's a very large, you know, industry, super competitive, commodity driven. At the time, if you remember, the roast and ground section of the coffee aisle was an entire grocery aisle and was all roast and ground coffee. And there were three players, Nestle, Procter & Gamble, which owned the Folgers brand, mm-hmm. and Kraft Foods, which owned the Maxwell House brand. So the three of us were duking it out for, you know, share in the aisle, and effectively just how I bought coffee determined the profitability of our business, which is why eventually Nestle exited the roast and ground business, because it proved to be just like, I can make more money trading coffee than I could actually buying it, roasting it, putting it in a can, getting it to the grocery store, selling it to a consumer. The industry, coffee industry today looks very, very different. And it's been quite interesting for me to see that evolution happen over time, where, you know, big food has rethought what that industry looks like. Obviously, the nature of that industry with the specialty trade entering and the impact that Starbucks and other specialty roasters have had on the industry has been profound. And even companies like Nestle have really rethought how to drive the industry. Nescafe globally remains a very powerful brand, but Nespresso has completely transformed the way they've addressed the industry by, you know, creating a very different, more reliable profit driver, and the margins in that business are considerably better than anything we ever could conceive of in the roast and ground segment, you know, 30 years ago. So it's interesting to see how an industry has evolved ultimately around the financial results that big food companies need to deliver. So, and largely the impact that has had is, you know, there's been no question, there's been a negative impact. The expense, you know, sort of if you look at average dollar wages in coffee growing regions around the world, they're very low. You know, it's a very challenged industry. Farmers do not generally collect a significant premium. That's not inconsistent from other industries. And that was really a big driver for me as I thought about how to affect food broadly in my career.
Okay, fascinating. I could ask 100 questions on this, but I'm not, because there's other stuff. So then you went from this to what?
So then I was asked to take on a role at Nestle managing a business. And so I took on managing the non-dairy creamer business at Nestle Beverage, the Coffee Mate brand. And that was a real shift for me from a, you know, purchasing role into, you know, really leading the marketing of what's a very profitable, highly branded business within Nestle. It has like a 60 share of the non-dairy creamer category. I just learned an immense amount having that. It was an amazing opportunity. I'd learned a lot about, you know, how big food works and how to, you know, communicate with consumers and affect their use behaviors through all of the marketing capabilities that one has at a company like that and a position like that on shelf. Super instructive for me. But at the end of the day, I kind of walked away saying, you know, what am I doing here in terms of, you know, my ability to both help consumers in terms of delivering healthy, really good quality ingredients to them to have a positive effect on the consumers' lives, while also, you know, thinking about, you know, anytime you're in the food business, it was very clear to me, you are in a triple bottom line business. You're affecting the environment because you're pulling things out of the ground. So the way you choose to do that has an impact. You're affecting people's lives on the ground, but also consumers' lives. And obviously so it's got a social component, and it's also a, you know, financially driven business. So there's a definite economic part of the equation as well. And so balancing those three became, you know, really clear. I didn't feel like in my role at Nestle, I was necessarily fulfilling what I considered sort of my obligation in the industry to balance all three of those, the environmental, the social, and the economic. And so I had a good fortune of, I had actually written a business plan and connected with a guy named Bill Nyman, who had just started a meat company in the Bay Area called, at the time it was Nyman Shell. I joined Bill. We created, redid the brand to be Nyman Ranch and developed that. It's a meat business. We were, at the time, Bill was raising cattle in Marin County. And then over the next 9 years, as CEO there, we scaled that business up and, you know, effectively transformed what became, I think, one of the most well-known kind of natural meat companies in the country, and had an amazing impact on the lives of over 600 sustainable family farmers by helping them access consumers by telling their story, and also by creating a totally new view on quality, how food quality could drive value. And I'm happy to talk about that if it's interesting, but it was a really fun part of my career.
And then how did you get to, or how did you start Agriculture Capital?
After Nyman Ranch, we sold that company to private equity. It's now owned by Purdue, where the company and the brand are thriving, and the protocols we've developed are still being adhered to, and Purdue's applying a lot of those to their poultry business. I started another company called Attune Foods, where we launched the world's first probiotic chocolate bars, which was a really exciting and highly innovative kind of lens on, you know, how to think about digestive health in consumers' lives. We acquired a number of heritage cereal businesses, including Uncle Sam cereal and Erewhon, which was the first big organic brand in the U.S. Dating back into the late 60s. Grew those businesses and then sold it to Post Holdings. And after doing that, I ran into some friends who connected me with my two partners or co-founders at Agriculture Capital, Tom Avenelis and Brooke Randall. You know, as we started to think about the opportunity, it became very clear to me that this could be an opportunity to do what I saw as being the big challenge in food, was not just having an impact in building natural food companies, but actually scaling up regenerative food systems by bringing institutional capital to bear on the opportunity. In the U.S., less than 1%, and this goes back now 15 years, less than 1% of planted acres in the United States were planted or being managed organically. Unfortunately, that's still the case. It has not expanded, but we said, why don't we see if we can have an impact there? Why don't we see if we can actually build some scale there to make organic more available to a broader set of consumers, and also to transform the landscape by focusing on regenerative practices to build soil health and nurture ecosystems and manage water infrastructure more sustainably. And I think we've done a tremendous job on that, and are really proud of the outcome that we've delivered there. So over the last nine years, we've invested about a little over $800 million to build a couple of very sizable verticals. We're now the largest grower of organic blueberries in North America. We process all that fruit on behalf of a number of other brands, and we also sell a lot of it frozen to the largest retailers in the country, folks like Costco and Safeway, Albertsons, and Walmart, Sam's Club, et cetera. We're really proud of that business. And we've made organic fruit available to way more people than have ever had that opportunity to consume that fruit before at values that are working for them, which is super exciting. And then we've also scaled up a big citrus business under the Sumo Citrus brand. It's a large mandarin that people may be familiar with. It's got a big knob on the top. We acquired that business about 9 years ago in its infancy, have planted a lot of trees, developed some really innovative farming practices and regenerative practices, both in the US as well as in Australia, to build that business and create real scale. And we're really proud of the way that business has grown. It's actually driving all the growth in the citrus category now. And so I've been able to combine not only this idea of transforming the landscape, but also we are demonstrating how you can do that while delivering a really valuable, nutritious product to consumers. So that's, to a degree, I've kind of brought a lot of my experiences together here and done that. And we're excited to continue that journey with future opportunities as well.
Well, it's helpful to get a roadmap of your life journey. And it makes sense that you're doing what you're doing today. I'll come back. I do want to hit on organic, regenerative, what those terms mean. But let me ask you this question, because it flows in light of what you just described. And this is a wordy question, but we'll see how see if it makes sense. How would you best describe who you are in the context of where you're at in your life journey? Because you've done a lot, and obviously you're at a unique spot. So,
you know, I really think of myself now as being a catalyst. I've had these experiences that have been, for me, incredibly informative and powerful, and given me a lens on the food industry that I'm very grateful for. And so I think of myself as being a catalyst for change through both sharing those experiences. I advise a number of smaller food companies who are entering the space on a pro bono basis. I really just enjoy connecting with folks who are, you know, entering this journey as well. And hopefully if I share some experiences, I can help them speed their path to success. But more importantly, I think about catalyzing, you know, this transition from a conventional form of agriculture that we've been broadly supporting as a culture over the last 100 years to one that is much more focused on, you know, nurturing the native biology that can be present in soils to drive comparably great outcomes in terms of yield and better outcomes in terms of food quality, but doing it in a way that is not so chemically intensive, but is really focused on a kind of, not to overuse the word catalyst, but, you know, using native systems to catalyze change in agriculture. And we think that, you know, I think personally, that's what I can do. I can tell those stories. I can get people involved. And hopefully we can bring, in addition to, you know, the capital that we'll bring to bear to drive that, the other big component, there's a human part of that story. And so if I can help, you know, regenerative farmers get access to that capital to drive the change more quickly, then we know that we'll be able to put carbon in the ground, we'll be able to nurture and enhance native ecosystems, we'll be able to conserve water, things that are all fundamental to improving our lives on the planet. And agriculture is unique in its role to impact all of that. And so that's kind of where I see myself and kind of how I think about my job going forward.
Why is it so important to you to be this catalyst?
I think it's important just because there's, you know, I don't know that there's any more significant challenge on the planet right now than not only feeding, you know, 9 billion people, but all doing it on a world that has limited resources, and clearly a world that needs to address some significant climate challenges. And so I feel super lucky to be kind of in this space right now, and knowing that agriculture, given that it affects 38% of the global landmass, has a unique role today. It is responsible for over 22% of global greenhouse gas emissions. And if converted to regenerative, could not only reduce that to zero, could actually sequester carbon from the atmosphere and put it back into the soil. So that's known technology that exists today. That is not something we have to invent to create. We actually know how to do that. We can make that happen. And so for me, that's I feel good fortune to have this experience where I've lived it, I've seen it, I've been in this industry. And now it's all about, okay, how do we do, we need to do more of this. We need to scale it. We need to catalyze that shift from, you know, a way of farming that has been quite extractive to one that is really focused on building soil health and putting carbon back in the ground, which leads to better productive outcomes.
So, you know, I hear you talk, and I hear, and this is not to be critical, kind of buzzwords that we hear in the marketplace, whether it's regenerative farming, whether it's, you know, climate change. Put some teeth onto that for our listeners of, if you were to take us to a field, to a farm, how would we identify of like, oh yeah, this is what you're talking about?
No, I appreciate you calling out the buzzwords. Thank you, Jeff.
Well,
you know, it's super, no, it's a great point. I'm so close to it that I take it for granted, but I'll go through a couple of examples. And to me, we now have over 10 years of experience at Agriculture Capital where we've actually been doing this work ourselves. We have incredible teams that have been kind of implementing these practice changes. We acquired, I'll talk about one farm in particular, but it's exemplary of what we've done across 28 different investments that we've made over that time period. There's a blueberry, actually two properties, 3,000 contiguous acres in Oregon, bordering the Willamette River. We acquired this. It had been monocropped in mostly mint for many years in a chemically intensive fashion. We acquired the ground. We developed it into blueberry and hazelnut orchards. As far as I'm aware, it may be the single largest blueberry farm in North America. And understanding that we were going to convert this to and transition from a conventional practice to organic, that was our business plan. We've executed on that. We also knew that as a big farm of that stature, it could have huge damaging impacts to the environment just because it was so significant and only one crop. You couldn't maintain some of the fundamental biodiversity that you'd have in a, you know, if you divided that up into 300 small farms, for example, that were all farming different crops. So we planted, we had read a study out of Michigan State, the potential for native pollinators to enhance productivity. So we planted native pollinator habitat throughout this farm, and in order to, number one, support other ecosystem services on the farm that I can talk about more, but specifically the sort of the financial incentive that we used to justify the work with our investors was native pollinators are more effective in pollinating blueberries than bringing in outside bees or European bees, you know, which are the standard practice in the industry. We eventually, as this native pollinator pathways grew and developed, we saw a massive increase in the presence of more diverse species of pollinators. In fact, over a 9x increase in species biodiversity in 7 years. We track this. We have field biologists out in the farms every year to do a census of all of the biology. And we've also, as a result, seen much better pollination services of the blueberries than we are getting in other farms that we're managing where we did not do that planting. We worked in partnership with the Xerxes Society that has been leading this charge around how do we support native pollinators is really an important part of our ecosystem and ultimately fundamental to human health in terms of the importance of being able to pollinate crops broadly. It's been phenomenal to see the results. Not only on that farm have we, you know, seen this huge increase in species biodiversity, but we've also seen significant increases in soil organic matter and soil carbon as a result. And we've seen, you know, productivity that is at the high end of what the industry is doing in terms of blueberry production. And hazelnut production, and we're doing it with far fewer chemical inputs. So overall productivity of the farm has improved. The costs are at the low end of what the industry is seeing. And we are able to supply, you know, organic fruit. This is all organically certified to a broader number of consumers at a price point that is more achievable. Mm-hmm. And so we are now, as I mentioned, the largest grower of organic blueberries in North America. We've seen, when we got into the business, organic represented about 6% of the U.S. blueberry market share. It's now 17% of the U.S. blueberry market share, which is awesome. So way more consumers are able to eat organically, which we think is really healthy. And so it's a very tangible example of, okay, you plant native pollinators, you manage your water resources right, you enhance biodiversity, you create food more efficiently, healthier food more efficiently, and deliver it to consumers. I think that's sort of, for me, the fulfillment of, you know, this vision of like, can you do it? So the answer is yes, you can do it. Like, it took 10 years. We've got tons of data to support this. And we've seen it happen on citrus. We've seen it happen on other cropping systems. There are great farmers, regenerative farmers all over the country who are, and all over the world for that matter. We have opened an office in Spain 4 years ago and have been looking at a number of opportunities there. Tremendous innovation happening in Europe on these same issues. Also in Australia, where we've made a number of investments. We have a team there. And we're collecting this data on all these systems that gives us confidence in our ability to scale these businesses, regenerative businesses up within agriculture to have a massively positive impact on all three of the things that I identified before: the economics of it, you know, the environmental impact of it, and the social impact. And so we're really excited about you know, how we bring further scale to that as we look ahead.
So explain to us how the regenerative practices work with organic?
Great question. There's so much terminology in the food space. It can be, I mean, we sometimes joke that you pick up some natural food packages and sort of like a NASCAR, you got all these stickers and badges and everything is certified Rainforest Alliance, organic, regenerative, organic, non-GMO. I mean, I could go on, right?
There's, right.
It's ultimately the consumer sort of what's going on? What am I doing? Regenerative, when we think about regenerative, it is a concept that is essentially about regenerating soils to diminish your reliance on using outside inputs. And so we think about shifting away from chemicals towards biological systems, which means enhancing the soil with, you know, microbial teas and developing mycorrhizal fungi in the soil to do all of the natural work that they do in transmitting nitrogen into plants and aiding their production so they can more efficiently pull carbon out of the air and, you know, go through the whole, you know, biology that should be happening in any natural ecosystem. So that's what we are driving for. And regenerative is really just that, moving from, you know, additives to fewer additives. Organic is a little bit of a step further, where you're putting systems in place that are tracking specifically what is and is not used on that farm. And those standards are established by the National Organic Standards Board. And then they're applied, and it's a process that has a lot of regulatory rigor around it, so that it takes actually 3 years of transition for a farm to move from conventional to organic. That means for 3 years, you cannot use any of the chemicals that are on the banned list to meet an organic certification. And then you become organically certified and you can begin to market your crop as organic. So that's a big financial commitment for a grower to make, because for 3 years you have a higher expense typically without the offsetting higher income. So there's a big investment. And then once you are organic, you have by definition a smaller tool set to deal with, let's say you have, you know, a pest pressure, like a common one, you know, that we face in some of these produce crops, or spotted wing Drosophila. It's a bug that will plant its eggs in fruit. And then, you know, you whenever you have it, the last thing a consumer wants to do is open a package of, you know, blueberries, and suddenly there's like bugs coming out of their blueberries. Mm-hmm. That would not be a good outcome. So, you know, we have to, instead of being able to, like most conventional growers, we'll just spray an entire crop to kill off and that pest when it shows up. That's the traditional model. In our case, what we do is we do aggressive scouting. So we have people out in the field. We put technology in place to identify anytime that SWD shows up, spotted wing Drosophila. Anytime it shows up, we can take very quick action with organic sprays, which are different than typical chemical sprays, to address it on the perimeter of the crop and cordon off those areas and make sure that we are not getting any of that product into a package. So it's much more, certainly more labor intensive, it's less chemically intensive and much more, you know, really when I think about a great organic farmer, they're just great biologists because they're looking for these cues to identify, oh, what's going on in that part of my field? What is the system? What is the systemic change that I can make? Can I put in more, you know, there are, you know, kind of pests that that may be subject to, you can bring in, you know, other bugs to eat those SWDs so that they are never become an issue, or you're planting the right perimeter pollinator habitat where you can actually house native species that will keep the SWD at bay before they even enter onto a farm. So they're really, you know, I'm not a biologist, nor am I a farmer, but I have amazing respect when I see these guys who are on our team out there and how they're thinking about systems management and biological processes and putting that into place at scale. It's nothing short of astounding. And it's a very different kind of mentality to food production than let's just buy this chemical and spray it everywhere because I know that will have an effect. You know, that's the way we've been doing it, and shifting to this new way, it's just incredibly exciting because the impact on our planet can be really, really positive.
So we have talked to many in this space over the last 8 years, and probably about 8 years ago, I got to go to a day where they were all farmers who have transitioned to organic, and to hear the farmer's side of the story. And two things stuck out at me. One was one of the farmers saying, look, if I was going to continue to farm the way that I was, it just, the idea of passing it down and to my kids just wasn't appealing. And I didn't go into all the details. I could guess why he was saying that. But what he ended up saying was traditional farming is like driving an automatic. And he says as he's transitioned to organic, he's like, it's very much like driving a stick shift. And he just says, it's so much more engaging. You're not just in autopilot, so to speak. Now, it sounded like it took a while to make that transition, but for him, it was like, now I'm farming again. Is that a concept? Does that make sense?
I love that analogy. I think that's wonderful. And I think it's spot on. I mean, I had a conversation recently with one of the farmers on our team, who's been, you know, he's a fourth generation farmer in the Central Valley of California. You know, what we're doing in terms of converting to regenerative is not at all the norm there. And it's taken time to get people to, you know, sort of embrace these practices step by step. And, you know, there are human beings involved in this. So that's the hardest part, because we are very averse to change as a species, and sometimes have a hard time dealing with it. So that's not lost on me, but we do get people to kind of think about this ultimately. And in talking to this guy, I said, Roger, this idea of planting cover crops in between citrus trees, we've seen massive success with it in Australia. I realized that, you know, the reason we don't today, as he was explaining to me, is that, you know, the ground temperature on the soil, which if you walk around the Central Valley of California, you see every citrus grove for the most part is bare dirt under the trees. And the reason for that is that growers are very concerned about the impact of frost. Frost is a threat to your crop. And with bare dirt, the sunlight will heat up the ground more quickly than if there was, you know, crop growing on it. You know, the research on this is quite extensive, and it shows that you could have anywhere from a one to potentially three degree temperature difference at the soil if you planted cover crops. So got that. That's totally understand that. And I said, well, Roger, we've got this other data that shows how we can reduce our nitrogen input fertilizer costs significantly by planting cover crop, which helps us fix nitrogen in the soil. It also preserves the topsoil during massive rainfall events to prevent it from just washing away. It also aids in significant water retention, so our total water requirements are lower. And so the financial benefit of cover cropping, and oh, by the way, it can help sequester carbon into the soil, which we can also get paid for. So the financial benefit of cover cropping compared to the perceived risk of frost damage is massive. By the way, we haven't had a really significant frost in the Central Valley of California in over 20 years. You know, I say that knocking wood, because, right, you know, we're seeing massive climate variations right now that will only probably increase in, over the next several years. And so it's not impossible, but we also have invested in, you know, huge infrastructure. We have wind machines that are like giant windmills you see in the Central Valley. And those are basically used to, there's one wind machine for every 10 acres. Each wind machine costs about $35,000 or $40,000. And the idea is that when the temperature drops, you get this temperature inversion where the cooler temps are down lower to the soil, and that makes the frost potential greater. And so you turn on the wind machine and it mixes the air and it pulls in higher temperature air from above and mixes it to the lower temperature. You'll see basically a 3 to 4 degree increase in your ground temps as a result of $40,000 wind machine, which, you know, that's $4,000 an acre capex that you're putting in to prevent frost, on top of the fact that we haven't had a frost in 20 years. You know, it's just, to me, the reason I tell that story is it's amazing how these old thinking can get stuck in a thought process that is very hard to change. And finally, I said, Roger said to me the other day, he said, you know, it's interesting, you know, I just realized that my grandfather, I went back and looked at his records. He kept meticulous books of how he was farming, and he planted mustard seed and all these other crops in between the rows of his citrus. And I was like, that is amazing. So, you know, if you go back three generations before the, you know, implementation of this highly chemicalized farming strategy, yes, farmers knew how to think about biology. They knew what to plant. They knew how to develop soil health. They knew how to manage pests with non-chemical means because that's what they had. And they, you know, just were farming that way. And to your point, we developed tools that made farming easier. And those tools happen to have, in many cases, some very negative impacts on, you know, on ecosystems, on, I mean, the water, you know, in the Central Valley of California, the groundwater health has been a major issue. There's, you know, huge issue, particularly this becomes, when we go through a drought cycle, it becomes incredibly evident that you're seeing very high levels of nitrogen in groundwaters, which is, you know, I think, you know, people don't want to call out an exact cause, but given the amount of fertilizer applied in the Central Valley of California, right, it is leaching into the groundwater. You know, the farming is the source of the problem. And so thinking about how do we go to solve that solution and what it means to, you know, the environment more broadly, as well as I mentioned, some of these other just native economic benefits, it gets really exciting. And so we're seeing that transition, and it's just, how do you get people thinking that way and thinking differently? And I love your analogy, Jeff, of the stick shift versus the automatic transmission is a lovely analogy.
So in that example, that $40,000 per 10 acres, I think you said, what's the break even between the lower inputs that would go into it if you had to put that $40,000 into a wind unit?
We're still okay with putting in the wind machines. I mean, it's an insurance. Basically, you're buying insurance.
Got it.
And so we also buy insurance, by the way.
Yeah.
So we're doubling down on the insurance. And the reason you do that in a highly valuable crop like citrus is that you're putting, you know, when you think about what the farming economics look like on that crop, particularly in something like sumo, which is very labor intensive as well. So we end up spending, you know, over $8,000 an acre per year in farming expense. And then we, you know, kind of see returns on a crop like that of anything from, you know, $15,000 to $25,000 an acre. But if you have a frost that can eliminate your entire crop, it's just not a great story, right? That's a disaster. Yeah. And so for many farmers thinking about, okay, how might I mitigate that with a capital investment over time? It's really interesting because wind machines is something that, you know, you can really understand. It's equally interesting to think about, what about regenerative capital investment? So when we think about regenerative transitions, it's really like investing in regenerative infrastructure, because if you're putting cover cropping on and you know you're going to be using less water because the soil can retain more moisture, well, California pricing of water has gone, you know, in a non-drought year, you might spend $100 an acre foot. That's just the electricity to pump the water to get it onto your farm. In a drought year like we had 3 years ago, that could go up to $2,000 wow. an acre foot. And if you need three, let's say you need, if it's an almond crop, 4 acre feet per acre, suddenly you're spending $8,000 an acre on water. I mean, there's no way you're ever going to, you know, it's a complete disaster. So you have to, when you're thinking about these risks and where to invest CapEx, suddenly to me, the idea of saying, hey, well, if you put cover crops down and you think about nurturing the biology, it's a pretty easy economic, kind of math to be contemplating for the farmer. Like, okay, my water costs are going to drop because I'm going to go from needing 4 acre feet to 3 acre feet. I'm going to have a more resilient ground system that is going to be able to withstand, you know, these crazy high water events we have, like these atmospheric rivers. In fact, I think this week they're predicting a Category 4 atmospheric river in, you know, counties north of San Francisco and inland. You know, that kind of water hitting the ground, if it's bare ground and you get this massive dump of water, you will wash away a ton of dirt. Mm. And that's, you know, what you're farming. So that's a really bad outcome. The damage could be massive. And if you were cover cropping, you're going to be able to retain all of that. So, you know, there's all of these, you know, again, it takes kind of a systems way of thinking about it. And really good organic farmers have been doing this for years. The step towards regenerative, just some simple things like start out with cover cropping. Don't till the soil often. Begin to wean yourself of, you know, apply some biological fertilizers instead of chemical fertilizers. Suddenly you'll start to see these transitions happen. And it's really step by step by step. And then eventually, you know, you'll say, wow, I just, you know, I've been doing everything organically. If I just now I look at the protocol, you know, I could convert and suddenly I may have an opportunity to sell my crop at a higher value because consumers will pay more for an organic.
All right. We're getting long on time, but this is fascinating. So I'm gonna skip a question. So if you want to, which is the power of capital, I'm going to switch to stewardship because I've heard you use that term as we've talked over the last several months. What does stewardship mean to you, and how are you playing that out with what you do today?
Yeah, we use the term stewardship a lot. And in fact, you know, as we think about some of our strategies, future strategies included acquiring farmland to lease it to other regenerative growers. In a classic sense, people would talk about those growers as a tenant. We think about what a regenerative farmer is he's a steward or she's a steward of the land. Stewarding the land for your analogy before, Jeff, I thought was great. That the conversation you had with the farmer who's like, you know, if my kids are going to be doing this. Farmers think about, I think they really are fundamentally the most environmentally minded people on the planet because their entire life is about stewarding the land and stewarding the environment that they're managing effectively. And so we think about stewardship as being, you know, that fundamental opportunity to how do you leave it better than you got it? And when we do, we have ways of measuring that. We actually publish impact reports on our website every year, and it quantifies what stewardship means. Like we actually measure 140 different things on farm to kind of quantify, like, okay, how much organic matter have we maintained or developed in the soil? What is our, you know, I talked a lot about native pollinator habitat or species by, what is the resultant species biodiversity? What is our productivity, our what we think about as crop per drop? So how much crop have we produced with on a given gallon of water? All of these measures that we're tracking are fundamentally in place to try to quantify what we mean by stewardship. We'll keep adding, you know, more things to measure. You should never run out of things to measure. We're getting smarter about it. We're understanding now after doing this for 10 years, you know, where we're doing well, where we could do better. You know, I think that what we're really excited about is as we look forward, our ability to work with other regenerative farmers. We know we do not have a monopoly on good ideas in stewardship and in regenerative operating of farms. There are so many innovative and fantastic farmers out there today doing great stuff. Our vision at Agriculture Capital now is, okay, how do we help them? How can we bring capital to their businesses so that they can use their stewardship on a broader, you know, on more acres. Fundamentally, you know, somebody, we had this discussion of the team the other day, you know, what is ultimately our measure of success? I think it's acres under regenerative management. And it doesn't have to be our management. Mm-hmm. We're happy to have it be, you know, other people that we're providing capital to, or, you know, helping to make this journey, using their ability to be good stewards of the land. And the reality is every piece of land is subject to a unique set of circumstances because of the climate it's operating in, the soil types, the crop selection. There is no one size fits all. And so it's really about, you know, finding stewards who can look at the what's happening on that piece of ground, understand the biology, develop an understanding of how to make it better, and then apply practices to deliver on those outcomes. And our view is that's what we're here to do, is help finance that transition, because it takes investment. I love the term of, you know, we think regenerative infrastructure. That's what we are investing in. So we don't call ourselves an infrastructure manager, but the more I think about what we are putting capital to work on, it's doing that, and it's, you know, providing a return to investors at the same time. But it's when we've demonstrated how you can do that and successfully, and we're just excited about what the future holds to really grow more stewards and have a bigger impact on the ground.
Yeah, you know, I've asked this question to 90 people or whatever it is, and I do think that land and farmers puts it a different, a lot of times we talk about stewardship, it's more financial. I mean, there's all different ways, but the idea of a farmer and the legacy that soil is what produces their legacy and the production, I think it just gives stewardship a different lens, and it really makes sense the way you describe it. You know, because you have this money over there, yeah, we're going to be stewards of the money, and you get it, but that money is electronic, goes away, but that land is like, it's only productive if it's being taken care of. So it hits me when you say that, how farmland, I think people can relate to in a different way. So I appreciate you sharing that. Okay. The last thing is, if you had one dream come true for your life, what would it be? And if you want me to say, leave your family out of it, because then you're not obligated to go that route, you could tell me either way.
Well, I've already had the great fortune of being able to, you know, my family's fabulous. Professionally though, I think really my one wish is that you know, the work that we're doing here at AC will prove to have a long legacy, and that we can continue to scale this impact. I think it's really important. We've got an amazing team of people here who are some of the most innovative and creative thinkers that I've had an opportunity to work with. And, you know, we are now engaging with land stewards all over the world, which gives me a lot of hope and excitement around the potential for agriculture to move into a whole new realm of impact. And that's really what I wish for. So I think we, you know, it doesn't have to be all us, but I think the work we've done here is exciting, and I'm really looking forward to the next chapter.
Well, I appreciate you sharing some of your insights, your journey, and it's just fascinating to see how everybody's on this journey. And I generally believe everybody's using that for good, but I also would say you've been very intentional, and I love the way you think about stewardship. So thanks for joining us, and don't forget to subscribe to New Lens with Common Good Capital on your podcast app of choice. Until next time, I'm Jeff Schaefer. Rob, anything you want to say in closing?
Jeff, thank you so much. It's a pleasure chatting with you.
This podcast is a production of Common Good Capital. It does not constitute an offer or a solicitation of an offer. Such offer would only be made through a private placement memorandum. Prospective investors in private placement securities should be aware that making an investment is speculative and involves a high degree of risk, including the risk of losing all or a portion of an investment. Investments of this nature are illiquid and subject to substantial restrictions upon transferability.